Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Wise words from America's original tech guru, and his name is not Steve. Hello, listeners. Welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. This is Bill Quinn, and today is April 22nd, 2013. And we are beginning a three-day design article that you can find on pages 34 through 36 in your Advanced magazine. And what is the title of that article, Naomi?
Good Design is Good Business.
All right, Naomi B. Sable in the house here for this design article. And I know, I'm glad you're here because I know you actually study this a lot as far as how to design good products.
Well, I try to stay up to date, Bill, but my education actually started when I was quite young. My mother's a graphic designer, and so I learned from her the importance of how things look. Now, that's a bit tricky because it sounds like maybe you're a little too superficial, but how they look also affects how they work. That everything is streamlined, works together well. And so she would show me, you know, oh, that text looks terrible there. Do you see why? If we move it here, it's much easier to read.
Yeah.
And I think often when we think of something like graphic design, we just think, oh, pretty colors. But there's a lot more to it about making a layout, for instance, that makes the most sense for the words on the page.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, this article shines a light a lot on technology, of course, but what you're talking about is, for instance, laying out a magazine. And listeners, I don't know if you realize how much work goes into trying to figure out what is an attractive design, an attractive layout. And I know you put a lot of thought and effort into that.
With the art department, we certainly work hard. But that's just one example. I mean, that's true with clothing. It's true with tech products. It's true with cars. The looking good part and the working well part actually connect more than you realize.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a lot more behind it than a lot of people realize. You don't just put together some circuitry and chips and make a computer. You don't put together just some words and paper and make a magazine. There's a lot more that goes into it. So Josh Mooney is also here. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Bill.
Yeah. I know that you are really interested in this article because you spent so much time in business and you really appreciate a lot of the methodology and strategy that goes into designing not just a product but even a structure of a business, right?
That's right. And I worked for a web design company for many years. So when Naomi's talking about graphic design, we've translated that into web products, applications, mobile websites, and how a user engages with what could be a great idea in theory is so important in terms of how to interface with it, the simplicity of it, the look and feel oftentimes determines success.
And we do talk about websites a little bit later in the article as far as some of the design of websites, the challenges that they have. For instance, the instantaneous nature of it and also the instantaneous copying nature of that. We'll get to that a little bit later. But I mentioned at the top of the program about quoting one of America's top tech gurus, one of the originators, and I said his name wasn't Steve.
No, not Steve Jobs.
Right. Who are we talking about?
No, we're talking about Thomas Watson Jr., who was the man that turned IBM into a world giant.
Okay. I know some of our listeners might have thought we were talking about Steve Marth here at the Studio Classroom.
Well, he not Steve Marth, but rather Thomas Watson Jr. is the one who originally said good design is good business. And so that's why we have a photo of him there on page 34. This concept is sort of where we jump off from. It's our starting point for today's article. So good design is good business. It sounds like two quite different things, or maybe rather most of us would assume that design is a tiny little sliver of the big picture that is business. But he's saying they go together hand in hand.
Well, I'm thinking about when he said this and when he was leading IBM and then when he said this also, America was transitioning from really the Industrial Revolution into a world of technology and not just making things, but then, okay, refining it to our, how does this stuff look good? All right, we have to move from just pure functionality to mixing style in with that. So he was right in the middle of that and helped influence a lot of that. So let's get to our first reading. We'll break today up into three sections. Our first one will be the left column there on page 34.
Good design is good business. These words, spoken almost 40 years ago, are the guiding spirit of our innovation age today. When Thomas Watson Jr. told Wharton students in 1973 that good design is good business, the idea seemed quixotic, silly even. To many people, design still meant the superficial polish of nicer homes and cleaner graphics. But Watson had earned the right to his beliefs. The recently retired IBM CEO was a business oracle, having grown the company tenfold during his tenure by transforming its signature product line from cash registers to computer mainframes. Along the way, the perception of IBM had changed irrevocably. Once rooted in the grime of cogs and springs, Big Blue had become the face of a new computer age.
Okay, good design is good business. And these words, spoken almost 40 years ago, are the guiding spirit of our innovation age today. So, and again, as Naomi mentioned, we have a picture of Thomas Watson Jr. there. And actually, that's how we start our reading.
That's right. It says, when he told Wharton students in 1973 that good design is good business, the idea seemed quixotic, even silly. Wharton is a school in Pennsylvania, the business school at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay, that's where people go to get their MBA at Wharton School. Now, there's this really interesting term, specialized term in this sentence.
Yes, when you see that word quixotic, you might think, where does that come from? It doesn't sound like any other words in English that I know. Well, you're right. Mm-hmm. It's actually from a book called Don Quixote, and that's spelt like quixot. So that's where that comes from. But it's written by a guy whose name was Miguel de Cervantes. And the main character in this book, he goes on a lot of adventures, and they tend to be kind of disastrous, I guess. They result from him having ideas that are maybe bigger than what's really practical. He follows his imagination, and he tries things that are a little crazy, a little silly. And so that's where this term comes from. If you're kind of a dreamer, and you're always thinking of things that are a little larger than life, maybe a little bit over the top, then that might be a bit quixotic.
Well, an example would be that he spent much of his time taking on windmills, yes?
Right.
So
you can read that if you want a challenge, but it's I'm warning you, well, in English even, it would be super advanced level. I think the original is in Spanish, right?
Our students could handle it. Our listeners can handle
it. They're
smart. Yeah. All right. Now, continuing with this Thomas Watson Jr. quote, to many people, talking about design, what did it mean to people?
Well, design still meant the superficial polish of nicer homes and cleaner graphics. And Bill, this is what you were saying, just about how things look. And that's what a lot of people think of when they think of design. They think how it looks. But that's not really fair.
Yeah, and especially at that time, again, people were more just interested in functionality of things, not things being attractive. And there were far fewer products to pick from in most fields. So
that's true. But they're saying that design was something people thought of as being superficial. So in other words, that's just the surface. That doesn't go deeper at all.
Yeah.
But he was arguing that actually design does go deeper.
Okay. Now, as we continue, Watson had earned the right to his belief, right?
That's right. He had just finished three decades leading IBM when he made this quote in 1973, a business that he had grown tenfold, it says, during his tenure. And right before that, it actually calls him an oracle. And when someone is an oracle, it's almost like they have this mystical power about something. They know so much about it. We call Warren Buffett sometimes an oracle of investing.
where does Oracle come from? Word lady?
Oh, goodness. So an oracle, it used to be more of almost a mythological or somewhat religious term. Mm-hmm. Where it would be someone who actually could see into the future. So if you look into, for example, Greek mythology, you might find examples of oracles who could say, in 10 years, this horrible thing will happen to you. So, of course, we don't really mean some magical person or sign. Mm-hmm. We mean people who it seems like they have that ability. They're yeah. such good investors or they're such good business people. And they'll say something that no one believes, but then 15 years later, it happens, and you think, wow, that person has a gift.
And when people – when they talk, whether it was Thomas Watson Jr. or Warren Buffett, everybody listens. Mm-hmm. They just wait on every word that this person is saying. So now, the interesting thing about Thomas Watson Jr. was that he succeeded his father. And his father was the original president and CEO of IBM for 30 or 40 years. So now – as we continue here learning about how they did transform the company from a product line of cash registers to computer mainframes.
I didn't know that. I think that's fascinating. Yeah. When they talk about during his tenure, that just means during the time that he was in charge, he completely changed the products that this company offered.
Yeah, they had adding machines and cash machines, typewriters, and then, of course, they had to move into computers. If they didn't do it, they would have died, right, Josh?
That's right. And the computer, even at the time IBM launched its computer, they weren't sure how big of a category it would be, an industry it would create. He is actually misquoted oftentimes that he said he didn't think there would be a market for more than 5 computers in the world.
Oh, he's misquoted.
Right. There is no actual proof that Thomas Watson Jr. really said that.
Okay. All right. So we need to be careful sometimes about some of these quotes that we read.
That's
Check
true.
Them out. Did the person really say that?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, along the way,
the perception of IBM had changed irrevocably. So if you do something irrevocably, that means you can't change it back. So, for example, if someone changes their will irrevocably, that means they change who they're leaving their money to in a way that no one can change it back ever. And so this is a tricky thing, kind of often used in a negative way. But in this case, I think it's very positive. When people think of IBM's today, no one thinks of cash registers. Mm. Everyone thinks of computers. So the image definitely changed.
Right. And that's what we explain in that last sentence in this section.
We say that once rooted in the grime of cogs and springs, Big Blue, which is IBM's nickname known throughout the world, had become the face of a new computer age.
Okay. Changed the image completely of the company. Now, let's continue with our next reading.
Watson had always been a pioneering advocate for design, going back to 1954 when he recruited Elliot Noyes to reinvent the street-level showroom at IBM's Manhattan headquarters. And as IBM transformed, it became synonymous with the rise of modernism. Only now, 19 years after his death in 1993, is Watson being proved right. Innovation today is inextricably linked with design, and design has become a decisive advantage in countless industries, not to mention a crucial tool to ward off commoditization. Companies singing the design gospel range from Comcast to Pinterest to Starbucks. But why now? What makes this moment different?
Well, even when he, you know, was early in his career, he was kind of a revolutionary guy, wasn't he?
That's right. He says he was a pioneering advocate for design. And when you're an advocate for something, or organization, you're speaking on behalf of it very passionately. So this wasn't something he just came up with out of the blue. It's something that he believed in very much. And one example of that was when he hired an architect to reinvent the street-level showroom at its headquarters.
So to me, this is an example of how he was also pioneering. He was one of the first. He kind of went ahead in a new way in how important he thought design was. Mm-hmm. And we see this example, you know, a street level showroom, that's sort of the place where you can walk in and check out the merchandise. So you think of it with an example being a car sales shop, mm-hmm. Or even an Apple store, something like that. That showroom idea has actually changed quite a lot in the past, you know, several decades.
Hey, so he's not just thinking about adding machines and cash registers and computers here, but he's thinking about how attractive their retail location is. Now, you had looked up as far as Elliott Noyes, right?
Right. Elliott Noyes, a very famous architect, part of the group out of Boston called the Harvard Five. And the most famous of that group was Philip Johnson. So Elliott Noyes was part of that team that developed some of the most groundbreaking architecture mm-hmm. in New York City and in Boston. And if you check out on Google a picture of Philip Johnson's most famous work, it's called the Glass House in New mm-hmm. Canaan, Connecticut.
Okay. So Thomas Watson Jr. was concerned about the style of the showroom. It just made me think last night I walked past a bank, a branch that was obviously just redecorated. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it was closed. But when I looked in, I was like, this looked like a showroom for like crystal goblets or something.
You were a little disappointed it was closed, weren't you?
I wanted to walk in and say, take my money.
Right.
It's so beautiful.
And that's the idea. And no one had really placed much importance on this before. They just thought a store is functional. That's it. But now he was saying, wait a second, how can we make this location so attractive, so appealing, and so pleasant to be in that mm-hmm. people want to walk in? Once they walk in, then they'll want to buy something.
And we see in the next sentence it was not just the headquarters that was affected, right?
Right. It transformed the entire company as a company that for many decades had just been known for making, you know, typewriters and adding machines became synonymous, it says, with the rise of modernism.
Okay. Modernism.
That's the explosion of new ideas and methods that came out of the 50s and 60s, that things made from modern materials, done in a very simple, elegant way, had power.
Right. And the funny thing about the term modern and modernism is that it does refer to an actual movement, but often people use it in a more general sense of just sort of progress and moving mm-hmm. forward as well.
Okay. Now, we see in this next paragraph, Naomi, about his legacy.
Mm. So only now, 19 years after his death in 1993, is Watson being proved right. So they show us in this article how he was a pioneer. He was an advocate for design already. But no one still was completely convinced that good design really is good business until really now.
Okay. And next sentence talks about how he is being proven right.
Yes, that innovation today, it says, is inextricably linked with design. So now we're buying products and services strictly based on the fact that they're designed and built in very helpful, unique, thought-provoking ways. And so those two are now inextricably linked, or it's almost impossible to separate the two.
Yes, I like this word a lot. If you look for the root inside, it's actually from extract. If you extract something, you take it out. But if it's inextricable, then you can't actually take that thing out from the other thing. So they're totally stuck together.
Okay, these two are linked, and design has become a decisive advantage in countless industries, and not to mention
a crucial tool to ward off commoditization. And this is a reason why things are now being designed in unique ways, is because there's so many of a certain product. If you go to a phone store, you can choose from 100 different phones. If you go to a bath store, you can choose from dozens of different countertops and faucets that are essentially doing the same thing, but they're trying to appeal to your sense of aesthetics or design in order to get your business. And that's this idea of commoditization.
Right. So many things are available that the competition is very, very stiff, and something needs to show people that you're different, you're special, your product is that much better, and they should spend an extra, you know, dollar on it that you can make in profit.
So if something is a commodity, it then is just price-based decision, like gold or silver or oil or something like that. But to ward that off, we're saying let's make our product special so people don't just base their decision on price.
Right. You think of the iPod. This is the ultimate example of design championing a category that was a commodity. There had been hundreds of MP3 players built before the iPod, and this one came out 10 years ago and just defined a new category simply by being designed so much better than anything else.
Okay. Next sentence is kind of funny.
I love this one. Companies singing the design gospel. Okay, so if you're singing the gospel, that means you really believe in something and you want to just share it with the world. You're excited about it. And so here they're singing the design gospel. Well, we have examples of companies like Comcast. Now, Comcast is a cable company. Pinterest, which we just did an article on a couple months ago. And, of course, Starbucks, which we're all familiar with. All of these companies have put a lot of emphasis on designing things differently so that that is what sets them apart and people are willing to pay more, maybe, or use something or make a choice based on how it looks and how it works.
Yeah. Certainly people will go into Starbucks because they're well designed. The interiors, they're comfortable. They like sitting there.
So. Right. And it also carries over to how they, for example, try to address you by name. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the overall style there also.
Yeah. Now, but why? Now, what makes this moment different? Let's find out in our next reading.
Good design yields higher profits. Apple's Rise offers a few important lessons about today's connection between design and business. The easiest is that design allows you to stoke consumer lust and demand higher prices as a result. Whirlpool's VP of Design, Pat Chivone, recently told me, "We're changing from being a manufacturing-based company to being a product company." It's not just about cost-cutting. Schiavone was hired 3 years ago from Ford, where he most famously rebooted the Mustang's design. Why change? Because good design is very profitable.
Good design yields higher profits, and what would an article like this be without talking about Apple?
That's right. And their rise offers a few important lessons about today's connection, it says, between design and business. And we have seen Apple's stock and its company rise just meteorically from 10 or 15 years ago. And a lot of that, as I said a little bit earlier, is attributed to the design of its products.
Okay.
Meteorically, like a meteor, like it's launching into outer space. And that's true. Apple has taken off mostly based on just how it looks and how it works.
Well, it seems like Apple has learned these lessons well, haven't they, Naomi?
Yeah, and they're teaching the rest of us, too. So the easiest lesson here is that design allows you to stoke consumer lust. And this is really what we were just talking about in the previous reading. If you stoke something, it's like stoking a fire. It's like making it hotter, building it up, creating more force there. So if you're stoking their lust, that means how much they want these products. And so design really gets people excited about a product. It makes them think, yes, that's what I want. And I've seen people do this. They see the Apple ad and they just light up and you can almost see, you know, them reach for their wallet already. So I think that's absolutely true.
I'm thinking of people lining up at midnight, you know, by the thousands just to buy their new phone every time.
Right. So someone like Apple can charge pretty much whatever they want and they'll still make sales.
That's why we see that demand higher prices as a result. People are going to pay big money for this stylish design, right?
They sure are. And another industry that's taken up the same sort of philosophy is consumer products like Whirlpool, which makes dishwashers and washing machines. And they have a VP of design. I was surprised that a company like Whirlpool would even have a vice president of design.
Maybe 50 years ago, no. But certainly today they need it because people who are buying these appliances, they want everything in their house to look right. look nice, right?
And to operate that much more smoothly and easily. And I have seen this in magazines. You know, I read women's magazines, and they have advertisements about, you know, keeping your home beautiful and tidy. And I never knew how much dishwashers and washing machines could factor into that. Mm-hmm. But they have color choices. They have smoother lines now, you know, beautiful glass doors so you can see what's going on. I mean, the options are endless now.
Yeah, and to understand how some of that has evolved, Pat Schiavone recently told our writer a special quote.
Said that we're changing from being a manufacturing-based company to being a product company. And you might think those are the same, that manufacturing and products are very similar. But no, manufacturing focuses on the building of something and cranking it out. You can picture a factory just cranking out the same bolt along a factory line. Where products, it's much more thinking about how the customer is going to use it at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now we very rarely just say, you know, I need a cup. Let me go to the cup factory. Because if you want a cup, the options are in the billions, right? Yeah. Like there's so many different designs, so many different options. So that's what makes it a product now. That, again, that's changed.
Yeah. When you are a manufacturing-based company, you are worried just about cost. And that's what this other quote is here, the second sentence of this quote. It's not just about cost cutting. A lot of times factories just want to be efficient, right?
That's right. Lower prices on materials, how much more they can crank out in a day. Where products, it's about not cutting those corners. It's about finding the best solution to solve a customer's problem.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, it's interesting how people will cross over in industries. They'll be in one field and then they'll switch over to something completely different, which is what Pat Schiavone did, yes?
Okay. Yes. Hired 3 years ago from Ford, where he most famously rebooted the Mustang's design. So he actually changed how a car was looking and then moved on to dishwashers.
Yeah. So he was in design, obviously has a talent, a gift for design. And Josh, I don't know, maybe you've noticed with the Mustang, maybe what it was 5 or 10 years ago and what it is now, but it completely changed it, right?
It has. It's beautiful now.
Yeah.
They've done an amazing job.
It's got this aggressive look to it, and it is makes me want to go out and buy one.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. But then we finish this day with the question, why change?
Right. Because he says good design is very profitable. So he learned that lesson at Ford by revamping the Mustang. Their profits went through the roof. And now he's taking that lesson to Whirlpool and creating products that they can charge more for because they look better.
Okay.
It's all about the money.
All right. Well, very interesting first day. I love how we talk about this design and try to understand what is behind it and the differences between manufacturing and productivity as far as making things versus making good products that are beautiful. That, as Naomi said, what's the purpose? About the money. You can charge more.
Right.
Right. All right. Listeners, come on back for day two tomorrow. Till then, this is Bill.
Josh.
And Naomi.
Saying goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.